This is the Medicaid Advisory Committee budget meeting for February 1st, 2016.
Welcome to the annual budget meeting that we have every year for the Advisory Committee meeting. Last year's meeting unfortunately got canceled due to bad weather. But we do have a meeting this year, and we're going to try to restrict it to 1 hour because everyone's got generally a pretty full schedule with respect to time, given the fact that the legislative session is currently happening. So I'll start off by announcing that Larry Lubar will not be available to attend the meeting, and nor will Carolyn Montoya. And Miles Copeland is unable to attend, but Stephanie Avery is approved to attend in his place. And that's with the Long-Term Services Department. Is that the Aging and Long-Term Services Department? Right. Okay, very good. Okay, why don't we start off with introductions, and we'll start off with Joey.
Joey Glenn, exec for the Home Care and Hospice Association.
Jeff Dye with the New Mexico Hospital Association.
Mary Eden Presbyterian, representing the Centennial Care MCOs.
Linda Sekovic, New Mexico Healthcare Association, representing long-term care facilities.
Stephanie Avery, Aging and Long-Term Services.
Jean Vareda, AARP.
Daphne Ren Hopkins, Children, Youth, and Families Department.
Jason Sanchez, Medical Assistance Division.
Brent Ernest, Human Services Department.
I'm Larry Martinez with Presbyterian Medical Services, serving as chair.
Good morning, Nancy Smith-Leslie. I'm the Medicaid Director.
Alicia Bothron, Medicaid.
Des Buff Barden, the Human Services Department.
Okay, Dale, might as well. You've
Dale Tinker, New Mexico Pharmacists Association.
Okay, well, let's start with the people in the audience.
Mike Nelson, Human Services Department.
Christine Barner, LSC.
Amy Dixon, Desert States Physical Therapy Network.
Lisa Rosenthal, Carriage Reaching Out.
Theodore Soto.
Scott Walker, representing Tri-Four Labs in Magellan.
Bryce Camacho, representing UNM Medical Group.
John Johnson, Presbyterian Health Plan.
Tina Rigler, Molina Healthcare.
Patty Keel, Molina Healthcare.
Chuck Milligan, United.
And Mary Kay Carra.
Well, welcome everyone. Okay, since this is really purely a sort of informational meeting, I don't think that there's a need for us to adopt the agenda. I hope everyone has gotten a copy of the agenda. Okay, if not, we've got some additional copies up here. But we will go to item number two on the agenda, which is why we're here, Medicaid budget projections.
Good morning to you all. Hope you're enjoying this nice snowy day. You have a packet of six sheets in front of you. It's the one that is the really, really, really tiny print. And we apologize for that. But it's the only way to get all this information on a single page. So we're going to go ahead and start with page 5 and 6 of the packets, which is the second to last, actually, we're starting with the second to last page, actually, which is the overall Medicaid enrollment. And I just want to go through a few brief comments on overall enrollment. We're continuing to see growth in nearly every category that we project. We are, however, seeing overall less projected growth in retroactive eligibility for pregnant women, as well as for eligible children. So if you look back down to column O, down to the bottom line, by June of 2016, we're projected to be at 883,824 individuals. And by June of 2017, we are projected to be at 924,709 individuals. So, those are the items I wanted to point out as far as enrollment is concerned. You also do have a packet, which a sheet, which is one sheet before. That is actually the children's enrollment isolated, which all of these individuals, of course, are a component of the overall enrollment that I just spoke of. So I'll go ahead and stop at that moment and see if there's any questions about enrollment.
Jason, just I know that the dramatic growth in enrollment is due to the expansion primarily. How would we determine, let's see, which what that population is, which of the columns represents the expansion. Yeah, okay, so it's K through N, I see.
K through N.
K through N, okay, very good.
Any other questions on enrollment? And we'll turn then back to the first page in the sheet, which is the FY15 projection, and that's an actual lag model. And just to refresh everyone's memory, that's actually based upon actual claims and MCO capitation experience. A few things I do want to point out there that have changed since the last projection significantly. Line 35, which is the health insurance provider fee, we actually received the assessment of premium amount from the federal government. And again, just to refresh everyone's memory, this is part of the Affordable Care Act, where every state is charged with an assessment associated with the Affordable Care Act, and we actually have the premiums now, so we were able to project it completely, and that's what that is, and that's what the major changes there, that line 35. The overall projected deficit is $82,260,000, and we are pushing that from into FY16. And the general fund component of that is $24,374,000 that we are pushing from FY15 into FY16. Are there any questions about the FY15 projection?
Jason, it might be helpful if you might just define a little more what pushing into. Some of us think we know what that means, but
Sure. Human Services Department Medical Assistance Division has this special authority where we can actually, instead of running a deficit, we can push those expenditures forward into subsequent fiscal years. So when I say push forward, that means that we push those expenses from state fiscal year 15 into state fiscal year 16, and they're counted as state fiscal year 16 expenses.
So does that mean that prior year push was 7 million? Is that a positive in the line right above the current year?
Yes.
So there's a positive carryover as well in that year?
That's actually an expense. So we pushed expenses from 14 to 15.
That's a similar question. So 7.2 million carried from FY14 into 15, and 15 to 16, we're talking 82 million.
No.
Correct. Correct. No, that is correct.
That's federal.
That is total dollars.
That's the total.
Right. Total dollars.
And
only a portion of which was state fund.
And of the 82 million, the 24 million is state share.
General
yes,
fund.
That's
correct.
Good. Okay. Well, at least I can understand that. Jason,
I don't know how to read these things apparently, but I mean, that would seem to me that should show up as a negative. But
so if you were to see the if we had an FY14 projection, you'd see a negative in 14. You're seeing a 7.274 positive in 15. So we took him out of the 14, charged him to 15, paid him 15. The next lines FY15 okay. Are the negative coming out of 15 going into 16.
It's clear I'm not going to get it.
think of this.
You'll
way.
See the same. Yeah. You'll see the same okay. Number of 82,260 as a positive in the FY16 projection.
But when you take it out of one year and put it into another, it's a plus in the year you're putting it into. It's a minus in the year you're taking it away from. Generally,
okay.
You know that's.
And so the 24.3 includes the 7. Right, theoretically.
Well, it's built in there. It's
yeah.
A part of what you're building on.
Yeah. Right.
It's part of what made it.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it accumulates.
Yes.
Okay. And as in the bigger picture, I think it's helpful to think about our enrollment has grown faster than we projected. Right. So we had appropriations that supported lower enrollment growth, and it's been faster. So these, from really 14, 15, 16, our enrollment's been much faster than we projected. That's the point to one thing is probably
okay. And Jason, unless there's any further questions, why don't we go ahead and continue.
And actually, just to refresh everyone's memory, and you're going to see this for every single year, we actually have two pages, the first of which is the actual expenditure page where we just identify the total expenditures. The back page is the one where we actually spread it out into the associated federal financial participation percentages, and that actually tells us how much federal participation we have on various categories of eligibility as well as various categories of service. Are there any other questions on FY15? Okay, moving into line 16, which is the expenditure page, it's the landscape page. A few lines that I want to point out that have changed since our last projection. Line 8 is one that I want to point out, and that's IHS Hospital. And we've seen a $4.4 million growth in that projection, and that's primarily due to growth in enrollment. Line 10 is the next line that I'd like to point out, which is clinic services. That one has a decrease of $10.1 million, and that's not necessarily a decrease in the projection. What we've done with this particular situation for school-based clinics, we've in fact shifted the methodology and how we actually pay them. So instead of actually doing a transfer of the state funds, we've now moved into a certified public expenditure model. So the amount that we're actually sending to them is less, but the amount of expenses that they're incurring remains the same. So it's really kind of an accounting anomaly that caused the change in this line here. Lines 18 and 19, you're going to see shifts there between the DD medically fragile and the MEVIA waivers. The net effect of this is really no change in the overall projection, but we are seeing more individuals in the MEVIA waiver program as compared to the traditional DD medically fragile. Line 21 is another one I want to point out. Centennial Care Physical Health, you see a major decrease there of $31.9 million. And that actually reflects a process that we went through to reduce capitation payments due to the MCOs. And that was part of our rate negotiation, primarily associated with the period from January 1st through June 30th. So we were successful in actually pushing our rates downward. The next line that I wanted to bring up is line 26 and 27, which is Medicare. And we've seen significant increases there in both of those programs for a total of about $7 million and change in Medicare premiums that we're having to pay on behalf of our individuals.
So that's the dual eligible population.
And if it's poor enough, Medicaid pays the premiums as well as the co-payments and the deductibles, right?
Okay.
Yes. Line 35 is another line that I like to point out, and very similar to what we saw in FY15, we have actual premium expense for that health insurance provider's fee associated with the Affordable Care Act. So we projected that at a higher rate based upon the actual data that we have. Line 37 is another item that I wanted to point out, and that's also Medicaid expansion. That's our physical health rates for Medicaid expansion population, and we've also been able to be successful in negotiating rates downward in that particular components of our Medicaid program. So with that said, that leaves us with an overall projected deficit of general fund if we turn to the back page. Sorry, do you have a question?
This is, the IHS, back up to line 8,
yes.
Those are
100%? Those are
100%. Okay, so that's,
yes.
Just clarify. Yes.
Are there any other questions on the expenditure page?
Excuse me, the amounts you mentioned, line 21 and 37, related to renegotiation of contracts, those are obviously pretty large numbers, but that was only for 6 month impact?
January to June.
Okay. And are those changes built into assumptions for the coming following year?
They are.
Okay. And Jeff, just to remind you, for the Medicaid expansion decrease, that's 100% federal during this time period, so it doesn't really help our bottom line that much.
With the fact that we're now going to be paying a portion of the state's share of that.
17, yes.
17,
so that will have a future impact in the 17. We're on the hook for 5% starting 1/1/17. Are there any other questions about the expenditure page for the 16 model?
Jason, just so there was increased enrollment in Medicaid, which was why we saw the increase in the IHS hospital. Was that just raw numbers of individuals who have not previously been Medicaid eligible but now are?
I don't know that it was, I would say that it was purely increase of Medicaid eligibles.
Could have been increase in utilization also.
Part is utilization, but part is that we were low. We didn't anticipate as many individuals would be in fee for service, and that's part of the component of this as well.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions about the extra page?
So is IHS the only fee for service or?
No.
Okay.
Our mass carrier, contracted and paid. Service.
Okay.
But line 8 of the projection model reflects only the fee for service component of the IHS hospital that we figure out.
Okay.
And that is based on the fact that the individual can make a choice, right?
Yes.
Unless they have long term care needs, then they definitely have to be in the managed care.
I think we can go forward, Jason.
Great. So moving on to the revenue page, which is the portrait sheet. Take you right to the bottom line 80. We, based upon the projected expenditure level that we just talked through, we are looking at having a deficit of $41.7 million in general fund in order to support the expenditure level that we're currently looking at.
And that is general fund?
That is general fund, correct.
And that isn't much change from the last recent.
About $42 million, I think, the last time we looked at it. Yeah, so it's right there.
It's right in that vicinity.
Change will be.
A few notes about what we're seeing since we actually put this projection together. The governor's recommendation for a supplemental for FY16 was just over $20 million. The LFC's recommendation was just over $33 million. So with both of those recommendations, we'll have to push forward expenditures into FY17 based upon this current projected level of expenditures. I do also want to point out that we are seeing some additional pressures that we've not projected in here that will be built into our subsequent projections. We are seeing individuals in higher cohorts in our LTSS programs of managed care. So we expect to see a little bit higher projection there as we move forward. We are also seeing a potential larger reconciliation process, which would actually be a downward pressure. We would actually collect funds back from the managed care organizations for individuals who are no longer eligible, also associated with our health services payments, as well as our hepatitis C component of our reconciliation process. And we are also seeking additional state share from the University of New Mexico to kind of support some of the programs that we've backdated them. And that would actually be additional revenue to us, which would reduce our overall need. So those are some of the pressures that we're actually seeing that will reflect in our next projection. Are there any questions about the FY16 projection model?
I'm curious what the term reconciliation means. Is that reconciliation with the federal government?
No, that's in fact a reconciliation with our managed care organizations. Yes. And the best example is hepatitis C. We actually have a risk corridor built around hepatitis C where if they're spending more than we pay them in the interim capitation, we take a significant portion of that money actually back to the managed care organizations. Hepatitis C.
If they're spending more, if they're spending less.
Mr. Chair and Jason, when you said push it into 17, is there any alternate thought about adjusting in 16 between now and the end of the fiscal year? Are we looking at things?
Well, let me speak from a technical perspective first. We're looking at a lot of different things. One of the components is actually seeking additional state share contribution to the University of New Mexico. And we are also seeing downward pressure of the reconciliations. So we are going to see a shift in terms of this overall projection. How much that is offset by the LTSS component may in fact, I don't know what that's going to end up being, but we do see a shift. So we're looking at a number of different things to help us get to that component.
I think we can actually, when we get through 17, we can probably have an overall conversation as to where we sit in the session and what we're going to get out of our first supplemental appropriation and what we think we're going to be in the recurring situation. I think we'll talk about those two things together.
Oh, okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Let me take this chance to, we've had a few more Medicaid Advisory Committee members join the meeting. So for those of you who just came in, could you please introduce yourselves, starting with Ruth? Yeah.
I'm Ruth Hoffman with Lutheran Advocacy Ministry.
I'm Mark Coleman, representing DOH. I work in Developmental Disability Supports Division.
Larry Chandler, physician.
Carolyn Anderson with the LifeLink, and I'm here on behalf of the Behavioral Health Planning Council.
Very good. Okay, well, Jason, I think we're ready to go into 2017.
We're moving to 2017. 2017 is, of course, a trend model built upon the FY15 and FY16 models. A few things that I want to point out that I necessarily haven't pointed out as part of this whole discussion today. Line 17, we are seeing a large growth in, we're seeing a large growth in projected growth in the other category, and that's tied to fee-for-service pharmacy, dental, and non-emergency transportation, and that's something that we believe is a component of us under-projecting the number of Native Americans that will be remaining in fee-for-service as opposed to managed care. So we think that's a direct correlation of what we've talked about in FY15 about having more IHS hospital patients. Line 21, I also want to point out the decrease there. That's carrying forward the rate ranges, or the rate rates that we actually have in place right now with the managed coordinated care organizations into FY17. Line 32, I want to point out as well, you're going to see a major decrease there. Previously, we had projected the rate increase for primary care services, and that is now built into the managed care rates above. So that's built into line 21 above and the other associated managed care lines. Line 34 is the same health insurer provider fee that is based upon the projected premium that we expect to pay in FY17. Lines 36 and 37 are also the carry forward of the rates that we talked about as components of the FY changes in FY16. Line 41 is the line that I wanted to point out before we move on, and that's we're projecting a total of $77 million in cost containment as part of this projection model. Are there any quick questions about the expenditure page for FY17?
And what do you mean by that?
Thank you for asking my question.
It was a question.
She got there. She got there first.
Yes.
As part of this process, we understood the need based upon the revenue picture that we're going to have to build in cost containment into the projection model. And that's the number that we settled on as far as what we built into this particular version of the projection model, a total of $77 million going forward.
That's in reduced expenditures?
Yes.
Okay.
So you just made it up, or, I mean, how
right. How do you get it?
We've got this dartboard here. No.
I guess
so
that's my question.
You're a couple, I guess,
take it out of pharmacy.
On the second page, in the revenue page.
No, we haven't got to revenue yet.
Yeah.
If you turn to the revenue page and you look at cost containment line 41, you see that $77 million in reduced expenditures. The federal share 54. So there's really a 22 something million dollars of general fund cost containment or revenue swap we need to do. So when we talked about this budget request, we said we have to address in one way or the other, either save $77 million or get some additional revenue. And we did talked about a couple things. One is another IGT agreement with hospitals, particularly UNM, to make about $20 million of that. Which really, if we do that, we significantly, it means we don't have to do a whole bunch of the $77 million of total cost. It leaves us $2 to $3 million of what to figure out. And we talked about that in terms of rates largely with our managed care plans.
And what does IGT stand
for? Intergovernmental transfer. So that's where we entered the session with, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think really we're now in a completely different conversation. So our $85.3 million budget request for FY17 in new money is what, three times the total amount that's available statewide. So there's $30 million statewide for appropriations in new money for FY17. We've laid out a budget request of $85 million. So the legislature's in a very difficult position right now of how to allocate $30 million across the state with, and we already need, say we need 85. So you know, I think where we are right now, especially for this committee, is really thinking about what we do to address a much lower appropriation and entering into another time period of cost containment in Medicaid.
Well, and Secretary Ernst, the $30 million that you referred to is really the latest revenue projection.
Latest revenue projection, new money for FY17 is $30 million, so they have to appropriate to schools.
Schools, higher ed, public safety.
This was a figure that started off at about $292 million and has been.
So it's come down about at least $200 million in the last projection. So
and could go down again.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Could you go down even further? Because it's this is what's affected by the oil and gas prices and revenues to the state, which are approximately about $15 million. Annual reduction for every dollar decrease in the price of oil per barrel. So that's the situation we're in. I hate to sound like make it even more pessimistic, but the available revenue could be even less than what the latest projection is.
So it's just, Chair, I have a question. So what's the total amount that you can push forward? Like if you had to look at
there's no statutory limit on how we can push forward. But we also can't be in a situation where we have a structural deficit in the Medicaid program. I don't think we can say we're gonna push forward the difference of 85 and whatever we get appropriated. I mean, I think we're gonna have to
figure out how to get it closer to the
we are gonna have to take some actions starting now. To make a difference in FY17 in terms of expenditure levels. So when I said I'd get back to sort of 16, I don't think there's anything we can do quickly to impact what we're going to spend in FY16. So we still think we're going to have this situation either potentially some additional revenue from if we have some agreement with the hospital, and then an appropriation of some level for a supplemental, which means hopefully we have to push forward less into 17 because that just compounds our expenditure to get to save. So I guess what I'm telling you is I think everything's on the table. I think we have to be in a situation where everything is on the table. And as you all are familiar with, you've been on this committee and known for a while, that those three things that you do quickly in Medicaid are reduce provider rates, change or reduce benefits, and reduce eligibility. And when I say provider rates, I also kind of include our managed care organizations in those, if you will. Mm-hmm. So, and I guess I would also put them in that order of expediency, if you will. So provider rates you can do more quickly. Benefits take a little more time. Mm-hmm. Eligibility, more difficult. And I also put them sort of in that order of acceptability, in a sense. We don't want to cut eligibility, we don't really want to cut benefits, but we don't want to do any of it. But we're going to have to do some of these things, and I think I'd put them in that sort of order. So I think Nancy, we can talk about this, maybe have an open conversation about this, is how you all can help us do this, because I think we're going to be in a year of in this mode, or a year longer. And we need your ideas and your thoughts about ways to address this. HAFC is going to wrap up their budget sometime this week, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll give everybody a picture about where things stand overall. But we're looking at a significant cost containment effort in Medicaid ahead of that, given the revenue situation.
You know, I suppose that we should take some comfort in the fact that things haven't changed all that much. Back in 1992, I was in Medicaid, and we were facing $240 million deficits at that time. Now, the one circumstance that seems to have changed somewhat, and I guess that's what I'd ask Secretary Ernest and the people from Medicaid, is that the federal government seems to have taken away a lot of the opportunities for matching intergovernmental transfers. Well, not so much intergovernmental transfers, but we did in those days have provider-specific taxes and a few other maneuvers that actually what saved us that year was we got a very large intergovernmental transfer from University of New Mexico hospital. And we also received a small intergovernmental transfer from the Department of Health. That was what bailed out Medicaid.
Oh, good. Look at that. What
do you think, Mark? Hey. That was the part that I could not speak on behalf of. Certainly coughing up $20 million, $65 million.
You don't need any of that $30
million. Well, we have a few requests.
It does seem like we pretty much maybe maxed out the ability to identify funds that could be used for Medicaid matching, but Linda?
I disagree with that.
Okay,
totally.
Good. Good.
There is
I'm
the
glad
opportunity.
To hear that.
There is still the opportunity for additional revenue through IGT programs to preserve services to, in my case, frail elders that have sustained all kinds of cuts and cost containment. So I think that, you know, the discussion of saying those opportunities are gone, yes, provider fees, the cap has come down somewhat. IGTs under scrutiny, but they're still starting these programs in other states and utilizing them. And I see no reason why we can't do that except the administration's position on no new taxes. And so I think that needs to be revisited to preserve. In my case, we're willing to be at the table and work on a program that can keep services alive. I just saw a report. It was actually developed by Idaho, but our survey experience, we are now 3 to 4 times the national average on the most severe deficiencies that are being cited in our long-term care facilities. December of 15, current numbers, current report. That is obscene to me. And I'm willing to be at the table to talk about other revenue possibilities and bring information that our national association would put together, whatever, to avoid any further reductions. Just, it's not sustainable.
Linda, are those are quality of care issues within the
survey
facilities?
Process.
Okay. Well, maybe it's got to be a two-pronged approach. You know, I think identifying any opportunities for increasing revenues, of course, has always been for a state as poor as New Mexico, something that we've taken a look at. But, you know, as we have sought to shift the system to one in which we're getting paid for on the basis of health status and trying to create a better system whereby we're not pouring money into inappropriate expenses such as inappropriate emergency department visits at the hospitals, you know. Have we started to see some of the impact of that in our Medicaid expenditures? Because that's, you know, that's where a lot of the resources are going, and they're not going there very effectively, and particularly for those of us who are involved in behavioral health issues.
Absolutely.
You know, and being a former member of the Christa St. Vincent Hospital Board of Directors, out of the 55,000 annual emergency department visits we had, half of those were behavioral health issues where it was the inappropriate setting for services, and it cost the system a lot. So, but are we starting to see any of the impact of that
move? Mary, you can jump in here too, because the MCOs created a work group to work on ER diversion initiatives, and I think there has been some success in that. You guys have been able to drive down some of the ER usage in the last 2 years, but still there's that education that needs to happen, because a lot of these folks need to learn how to navigate the healthcare system. We tend to go, especially the new expansion folks, are going to the ER more frequently than the rest of our population, but also using community health workers has helped to educate folks. You guys have a whole triage system with Presbyterian.
We do, and I think, Brent, you've shared some of those slides and some of the outcomes for 2 years in Centennial Care and the reduction in the low acuity visits in the ED, and I think we're well positioned nationally, really, the results show. But we're also a very rural state, and in many of our communities, I mean, the hospital, they don't have urgent care centers, right? So. And so there is an education component, but hospitals also have Entala laws that that they have to follow. So how do we strike the right balance where in the areas where there is capacity through urgent care and other means that we shift, you know, those visits there, but also preserve access in those rural and frontier areas.
And I would also add that even in our rate setting process, we have already built in some of those savings, which helped us lower the rate. So all of those things are happening and in effect, and so now we're kind of beyond, in addition to that. What else are we going to have to look at?
Joey?
Mr. Chair and Brent and Nancy, it seems to me that we are in a much better position now than we were 3 years ago in the sense that we have a lot more data. We understand how people use the system, when they use the system, why they use the system. What I'm asking for is that I know because of the people that I talk to on a regular basis that you have lots of conversations with managed care organizations. I would ask you to open that up a bit and bring in the people that are on the ground doing the work. I think we would have some good suggestions in terms of how we can expand the services in the sense that the hospitals, the MCOs, everyone is kind of working at certain kinds of things, but I don't believe they're involving everyone in those kinds of discussions. And we keep pushing forward through our association, I know Linda does too, with ideas and how can we make things better. And we have a good discussion at our meetings, but we can only go so far if the state isn't involved in that and doesn't know exactly what we're doing. So bring us in. I think we're highly effective. I think we can talk about what happens on a regular and a daily basis. I know that my partners at the MCOs are very willing to work with us when we have suggestions in terms of working with care coordination, working with the teams within the organizations, and how do we take care of these folks better. There are different reimbursement models that we should be looking at, that we should be testing. There's telehealth opportunities. And what I run into almost every day is this rigidity. Oh, you can't do that, or it's not in the rules, or, oh my gosh, God forbid. I think we need to look at this in a more comprehensive, what's really happening and what are we really capable of, and stretch it a bit.
Sure.
And I think there's evidence-based practice out there where we can demonstrate that you don't have to necessarily see somebody eyeball to eyeball to be effective, and that you can use all kinds of different ways and mechanisms to accomplish those same kinds of things. I know my MCO partners are very open to these kinds of discussions. I think I'm knocking on the door again. Let's in. Thank you.
Daphne?
My question is a little bit different. So as you guys have been working with your calculators, how much money do you think you would need to do in that first category of provider rates? And do you have any ideas about where you'd start? Because it seems like to me we're in that, as I've listened to you, we're there. So how, and you're asking for our help, but we're looking at cutting dollars at this point, right? We're 6 months away from the new fiscal year. I'm in agreement with all of these ideas, but...
like a parallel check.
Right. But then at the same time, it's a very sobering topic, but how much money do you need, where do you need it?
It's a little bit difficult to answer, I think, because I don't want to get ahead of, I don't want to get ahead of HAFC and their process, and you know, Senate Finance has their process, so I don't want to get ahead of where we end up. So it's a little hard to say, but you know that, and I could dovetail a little bit on something that Joey said, I think we have to break this into short-term and long-term. So what can we do quickly? Because we're going to have an FY17 shortfall. What can we think about that might also be something we need to do, but maybe it's going to take us a little bit longer? Because, you know, the FY18 appropriation is going to be need. It's going to be significant, too. So
that's part
there's
of
a general, there's a general, I think there's a general belief that the revenue picture is going to improve. So whether we need to get all the cost containment out in the 17 or how much is left at the end of 17, we've got to work through some of that. But you can, I think you would expect us, I think we would expect that provider rates are probably in the first place that
that we have to look and put this place in the look by the larger dollar figures.
I was just wanting to get a sense if you're thinking like 3% rate cut, 5% rate cut, if it would be, if there's opportunities across
and which,
the board.
And which providers,
certain,
you certainly talked to, I know Linda has been working very hard and has some real concerns about the current structure. Others do too as well. But you would look across the groups.
Well, and it always has to be weighed with the issue of access, because I remember the days too when we paid so poorly that getting any providers out
mm-hmm.
there to take Medicaid eligible individuals was a real challenge, and still does remain in many quarters today. I would ask Linda one thing. Could you just talk a little bit more about what your idea is? I'm not sure I'm understanding precisely how it represents or could be characterized as a tax increase.
The governor has refused to deal with provider assessments in the past.
Mm-hmm.
A re-energized, better version of the old bed tax that exploded.
Oh, got it.
That program, and here's a big difference. If we work together and construct a program that can cover providers' costs, deal with some of their issues, then we're willing to, step up. Like I said, the cap on our revenues has been reduced, but on IGTs, Texas had started an IGT program with nursing facilities and hospitals. I've had very brief conversations with Jeff about, mutual interest in helping preserve our services, which is my situation right now. The Income Support Division Director ran into one of the first facilities that has started to refuse pending admissions because eligibility is so screwed up within the Income Support Division, taking 3 to 6 months for eligibility when we provide care without payment for that long. It's not sustainable, not with the rates that we're being paid now, or with the revenue that we have due to that change in level of care criteria that affected revenue so drastically. So we've looked at various opportunities to try to make services sustainable. In her email to me, she indicated that she wanted to talk to this one facility, but there had been others that she had talked to. This was the first I'd heard about it. We don't talk about, any kind of actions like that jointly. We're prohibited from law. So I was really surprised when they've evidently got facility admission problems, access problems with what's happened. But that facility, I learned, had 20 pending residents in a building that has fewer than 100. So 20% of the people they aren't being paid for is what that means. That is just not sustainable. We can't continue to do this. And all of the problems within income support, timely payments or adjustments from the MCOs, when we do have rate increases and it takes, one of the MCOs says, 5 months or whatever, those things are just not acceptable under the environment we have today. So that's why I'm willing to look and delve into the IGT stuff. The provider fees are in the majority of states.
How many public nursing homes are there, Linda?
It would be a matter of public nursing homes. It would be private nursing homes
partnering
with public
hospitals. Well, I'm happy to sit. We're happy to keep things on
because
the table.
There are only the three state
right.
facilities.
So no private dollars cannot be used to match a Medicaid payment. So let's be very clear that CMS has indeed clamped down on provider tax arrangements.
Yeah.
So you can talk about the administration not willing to look at it, but it causes problems in states that have tried to do it. And it, because it is what it is. There's a movement for doing provider tax to hold providers harmless from these things, and
I think we need
to
probably
it,
research it a little more because dealing with companies that have operations in multiple states,
mm-hmm.
I hear about the success stories as well as the agony of defeat. But, but there have been
as
some success stories.
Experienced in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to delve into that with you.
I think a lot of us here at the table remember the last go at the nursing home bed
tax. We cannot lose money by putting up money to bring in match. We can't do that.
But it also didn't go very well the last time either when the effort was made. You know, we've had some pretty big disasters. But, well, any further ideas and discussions? Dale?
Well,
yes.
I'm going to go back to a conversation I've had the last couple meetings, and that is it's hard to put forth ideas for improving in pharmacy, which is who I represent, when I don't know what the data is. And the last two MAC meetings, I've asked for data and still don't have it. Centennial Care has been in place long enough that there should be data. So I'd like to make recommendations. I know in April, CMS is mandating a move to average manufacturer price. Is Medicaid dealing with that and looking at how that move? I mean, it's a federal mandate. So
we have our actuaries working with us on that.
Okay, so, but nobody talks to me about how that could be implemented and how that'll affect pharmacies. That's a month or so away, a couple of months away. Have nothing to tell the pharmacies about what's going on. And I'd like to know. I mean, they'd like to know. Mm-hmm. Because that's going to be a big deal. They do a federal survey. We see it as that it will reduce reimbursement to pharmacies. So, in the federal upper limit, I mean, it's not broad based, but so I'd like to see some data. I mean, I can make recommendations. Going into Centennial Care, I recommended implementing a medication therapy management, which is you can look around the country, you can look at the studies, and it works. It saves money because we have an adherence problem. We have a problem of people getting medicines they don't need, or they don't take, or you know, or they don't know how to take because somebody hasn't really advised them correctly. And so there are programs that can do that. But I mean, the discussion when we went into Centennial Care is it's another cost. Not looking at the potential savings. So there are recommendations we can make, but I really need a chance to look at some data first to see where we are. I don't even know where we are.
Dale, what you say is very true, and I'll just share with you one anecdotal situation. We at Presbyterian Medical Services, because our providers have been so frustrated in terms of trying to determine what our patients are taking, you know, what medications they are, we just went out and bought a bunch of their small medication bags. Mm-hmm. You put in everything that you've got and come in and see us. You
bring it to the doctor.
And that I know it sounds pretty elemental, but that's how desperate providers are to try to understand what the patient is taking, because half the time they don't know. And the patients don't even know. They can't recollect themselves sometimes because they've seen multiple.
Well, especially us old people, but you know, it's a basic brown bag medication review is, that's basic, but medication therapy management is a step beyond that, and advising people, that especially that take lots of meds, how they should do that. Beyond adherence, if they're even adhering correctly, it should reduce ER visits and those things, and doctor visits.
and I'll look to my colleagues, but from the other plans, but some of us do that with our population, so it's important.
Right.
I understand it's
critical. But it's kind of not a planned.
Yeah.
You talked about hepatitis C, and I'd be willing to bet most of that discussion is around those $90,000 drugs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Ruth?
I just to back up a little bit on the discussion around emergency room use and how that trying to bring that under control. And so some of us are a little alarmed about potential cuts in behavioral health services, which can have a domino effect on other parts, whether it's pharmacy or the emergency room and all those kinds of things that, and so I know that the LFC has recommended larger cuts than has the department. And those are very worrisome for the long term because I probably get disagreement here in this room, but our behavioral health system is not in good shape compared to other states, which I am familiar, having a family member who accesses behavioral health services in another state, and it's way far above anything that might be available here. And so I think we have a lot to aspire to that can impact costs over the in our system. I think that's a place not to make cuts at this point.
I'll point out that, you know, we're just talking about the Medicaid budget here. The changes you're talking about are in our behavioral health services division. We are still, there was a significant difference between the two recommendations, and I would hope to improve that through the House process, but we'll see what happens.
Let's see, I saw a hand out there. Well, I think it was in response to what Mary may have said.
My name is Lisa Rosenau with Parents Reaching Out, and I just want to kind of give a beacon warning. I sit on the Lucille Packard Foundation's Complex Healthcare Task Force, and so we're a group that work nationally with providers, families, et cetera. And what we're seeing nationally is these families that got absorbed into Centennial-type 1115 waivers, and their respite and their community-based services are being reduced, we're seeing big upswings in readmissions, and that's happening in our state right now. So especially those kiddos that came in under the D&E or who are now coming into long-term services, their budgets are $1,300. You can't do a lot with that, and that's being restricted to respite, so that's like in areas of 100 hours of respite a year. And so families are being forced into putting their kids into long-term programs or more residential settings. And that's the whole point of those waivers, was to keep people out of the institutions. And so I just kind of want to caution, as we're talking about this, to really keep an eye on those children with complex behavioral and healthcare issues, because they're more expensive to begin with. And then we're going to hit a tipping point at a certain point where it's going to be less expensive to institutionalize our kids. And then we're going to go back to where we were before, where our life expectancy of our kids is going to be about 18 years.
Did I see any other hands here, these committee members?
Yes. I guess one of the comments that I get real concerned about is when we talk about provider rates as if it was just one level of providers. And I think that no diversion program works unless you divert from one place to another place. And so keeping them out of the ER, I totally agree with. But we have to build up our community-based systems, not our MCOs, our community-based systems, in order to really be able to follow. And so I get really concerned when if we don't really look at the fact that it's not one group and one big thing, that we have actually a whole list of things. We already have issues with workforce. And so workforce is absolutely related to whatever the rates are going to be and the billing is going to be. So, you know, we can't divert from a higher level of need but have nothing available that is going to be able to, you know, work with the person in the community. And, you know, if we could solve some of the issues of our diagnosing and our being able to treat well and have some nice new medications that fix stuff, it would be great, but that is just not the case. And those individuals will continue to have ongoing needs for a lifetime.
Okay. Well, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. We've heard a few responses. I think additional data, additional dialogue with providers, and I'm not sure when the next Medicaid Advisory Committee meeting is scheduled.
It should be April.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Maybe we should think about either in the next few minutes just a framework for having this conversation sometime between now and April, either additional work groups or for once kind of digesting what we end up with the session and where we think we might have to go quickly, what could be a longer term, evaluating some of the short term cost and longer term savings of some of these ideas. All of that is on the table. I think we also have to be careful. I think I've heard a lot of Medicaid directors talk about everyone has a cost-saving idea, but it usually involves spending more now.
Right.
That's going to be a really tough position for us,
right,
given where we're going to be, because spending more now to save 2 years down, a year and a half, 2 years down the line is going to be
not a good environment for us.
Hard sell.
So I'm not saying we can't talk about it, but something we really be cognizant of. So.
What's the pleasure of the committee? Would you like to establish a subcommittee which is made up of some of the providers and some of the members whereby we could work a little more closely with Medicaid staff and talk about some of these things and flesh them out. You know, I agree. I think it helps you if we can provide you with information in terms of what we know about what's going on in the various industries, if we can try to at least price them out a little bit, and then get a sense of where it's worth going for. You know, I know over the years, Medicaid's like this one program where we've hit certain areas on a piecemeal basis, reductions in some areas and so forth, but it generally also tends to wind up in creating greater expenditures in other areas, you know, and I think that's what makes Medicaid so elusive is that we have to look at it as a whole and recognize that every time you make one move, there's a consequence someplace else. And we've always got to be cognizant of the access issues because we've always been traditionally one of the poorer payers, although I've seen a shift even in the manner in which providers do deal with them. I remember very few providers would take Medicaid at one time. Then all of a sudden, at least if you took Medicaid, you've got a payer for a lot of the patients that are out there. But do I have any volunteers to serve on? Okay, very good. Daphne, Linda, Ruth, Mark, Joey, and Dale. And Carol and I.
I was going to say, I'd have the behavioral health in there.
Right. Okay, well, that's a good cross section right off the bat.
I'm thinking we can meet maybe the week after the session.
That would be a good idea. Yeah. Let's give it a shot and see if we can get together and give you some concrete ideas with which to deal.
Well, by then you'll know exactly what you're not going to get from that.
I would add my name to that list if I can.
Okay.
But I also would not completely take off the table that some investments in some changes in the program can bring long-term benefits.
I agree. I didn't mean to say we take it off the table. I think there are lots of maybe ways we can work better together at certain levels and you know, shift requirements around. I think the same kind of structure we're looking at in our behavioral health system. Are there rules and regulations? Are there way we're paying for things? And the workforce shortages we need to be addressing system-wide to address better care that may not even require new money, but could be improvements in the system overall.
Is there any chance I can get pharmacy data?
Pharmacy data.
What kind of pharmacy data do you want?
Well, number of prescriptions, how much is spent.
I did give
because
out
general overall
spend at one point last year with the top 10 drugs that the spend was on, but we can do further.
I mean, as much depth as I can get. I have an analysis from Kaiser Family Foundation of what's spent in prescription drugs for the last 12 or so years. An average in New Mexico is the lowest expenditure in the country for prescription drugs, still is. Except for 1 year when Arkansas beat us out for lowest. But
thank heavens for Arkansas.
But I mean, that's broad numbers. I mean, that's really broad numbers, and Medicaid is different than that. I mean, it has different numbers.
Linda?
Mr. Chair, gets to Dale's request. We've asked repeatedly for information that breaks down, according to service, the budget expenditures to the MCOs and how they spend that money, so that we can track these kinds of things and know what the indicators are on a per unit, in my case per day, you know, delivery of service. I just think that we need to have a dialogue and that information on an ongoing basis so that we can see what is driving the program costs, these humongous categories where you've got, you know, $1 billion in a category for long-term services, as an example, isn't helpful in showing how we might want to target bending the growth curve in terms of a long-term, you know, fix. And so I just want to put that back out on the table. Like Dale, hungry for current utilization, average payment, all those kinds of things, that kind of data.
Well, the more information available, the better informed we are to try to make some recommendations. So, hopefully we can all work in that direction. Any other recommendations, suggestions? Anyone have the magic silver bullet that will...
I think Jason can get it.
Sure. Yeah, that. They just need to come up with another resource other than Boilermaker.
Get more authority to push this forward.
I don't know what it is.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, let me... I know we may go over a couple of minutes or so, but we do have on the agenda, I believe, a public... Do we have a public comment?
Yes.
Is there anyone in the public who... has not already commented that wishes to, or did we? Yes, Ellen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ellen Hines, representing the Disability Coalition. I'm so glad that Linda brought up again, channeling Roland Busciaga and Michael Healy, who for years have been asking for breakdowns on where the MCO money goes. We talk about the MCO money as the MCO rates, and whether they go up or down, but we have no idea where the money actually goes, and more data on that. As a problem, and Michael have been saying for years, and as Linda has just reminded you, I really want to second what she said. Following up on Linda's comments about the possibility of provider assessments for IGTs to raise money, that's going to need some research. We toss around comments about, oh yeah, we can do that, or oh no, CMS is clamping down. But you know, I got involved in this, as you know, Mr. Chairman, years ago, back when I worked at HSD, and we were very successful in getting CMS to match some tax revenues. There have been changes in the law since then. There have been changes in position from CMS. Somebody needs to do some serious research pinning that down. I know that I and my colleagues have looked into that in recent years. I'm sure HSD has. But we really need to get a good sense of what is permissible before we say, yes, we should do this, or no, we can't do it. Because I think collectively in this room, we don't really know exactly what we can do. And we need to know that if we're going to move in that direction. And there was one other point. In terms of the involvement, Joey said you've had this rather hermetically sealed process where HSD talks to itself and to the MCOs primarily, and she was urging bringing in the providers. Please bring in the consumers as well, because consumers have been largely shut out of the discussions about implementing Centennial Care and other parts of HSD, and sometimes that's gotten you all into trouble. There have been cases where you belatedly realize there's a problem. Either you realized on your own or somebody brought it to your attention. You can catch those things far upstream if you talk to people more. And please include consumers as well as providers in that. And that's probably all I wanted to say at this point, and I appreciate you letting me go over a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. Anyone else? Yes, Mary Kate.
I'm Mary Kate Garrett from the Mexico Alliance for School-Based Self-Care. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know you've heard us say this in the past. I feel obliged or obligated to say it again, and that is that school-based health centers are a wonderful access point when you are trying to divert from the emergency room or just prevent kids, keep kids well. And so I encourage you to keep that in mind as you go through your evaluation process. And we're very open to working with you in that regard.
Thank you, Mary Kate. Anyone else? Yes, Ellen, second time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I thought it was one thing I was supposed to say, and I'll do it very quickly. This isn't a cost savings idea, but as part of the discussion, I would really encourage all of us to be reminding legislators, appropriators, and others that Medicaid expansion is making money for New Mexico in very large dollar amounts. Right now, I think there's general agreement that until at least 2020, there'll be a net gain to the state from Medicaid expansion for the current year, last year, even next year. The budget is floating on Medicaid revenues to a large extent, and I would encourage you all, every time a legislator says, Medicaid expansion is eating our lunch, to remind them that we're making money on it. That's my bumper sticker. Medicaid makes money for New Mexico. So I urge you to carry that message into the debate and remind people about it. And I don't actually have that bumper sticker. I would sell to everybody as a fundraiser.
I thought it was going to be lunches on Medicaid.
I'll just add that in part because we have a provider tax in essence that does that. That's what the premium tax is in New Mexico in essence. So that's where we also run into. We already have a premium tax, and you can lay a certain percentage, so there's not as much room to
But yes, okay, very good. Any more words of wisdom? And I think we went over 5 minutes. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. So moved by Ruth, seconded by Dale. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much.